I may not be any good, and you're whistling and clapping. Let's see that. Good morning, everybody. My name is Matt Holland. I am an alcoholic. And first and foremost, it's going to be interesting how this goes. I started getting sick on Thursday, and I had a horrible evening last night. So I'm sweating now, and I'm feeling a little rough. So we'll get through this the best we can. Thank you. It's been a fantastic weekend. Chrissy and I have really enjoyed ourselves, and thank you for your hospitality and the friendship. For the record, I would think that you might, if the speaker plays golf, you may want to put him on the winning team in the future. that just goes without saying, I think. Walt and Phil and I, we struggled really hard, didn't we, on Saturday, and we didn't get no payoff for that. So. Edith, it's good to see you. And Edith and I got to spend some time together in Huntsville, Alabama last year, and we had a blast. And John and I share the same sponsor, and it was good to spend some time with him this weekend. And Linda, that was one of the best out-on talks I've heard in a long time, so I really enjoyed that. If you'd asked me when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous why I was an alcoholic, I would have given you a list of things that the reason why. I would have told you I was an alcoholic because I was in and out of jails. I was an alcoholic because I was in and out of institutions. I was an alcoholic because I was in and out of marriages. I was an alcoholic because of circumstances, and I thought that that's why I was an alcoholic. So when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys started talking about this being a disease or calling it an allergy, it really confused me. Allergy was just kind of a strange word or a strange term that they use to describe what it is that we have. You know, when I think of an allergy, I'm allergic to cats. I think of the, you know, watery eyes, the sniffing nose, the sneezing. So when I think of an allergy, that's the kind of thing that I think of. So, you know, my teachers in the program have always taught me that, especially when I go through the big book, I usually have a dictionary with me, and we're going through and looking at stuff. And I looked up the word allergy, and it says abnormal reaction. That's all it is. So when I put alcohol in my system, I have an abnormal reaction that acts a lot different than it does in your normal person. So that made sense to me. And if that was my only problem, you know, the solution to that would be pretty simple. Just don't drink, man. Just don't drink. You know, but I have another problem. I'm crazy. I've got a head that tells me time and time and time again, no matter how bad it got, that this time is going to be different. This time is going to be okay, and I'll start and race all over again. I assure you there's never been a time that I have ever wanted to throw a cat in front of the car and go right around town. I never wanted to do it. But I did it with alcohol over and over and over and over. And this is the last place that I thought that I would have ended up. From where I started, Alcoholics Anonymous is not the place that I thought that I would have came to. I'm the son of a Southern Baptist minister. And as I've said, this is the second time I've spoken on a Sunday morning. I think it's kind of interesting. I'm behind a podium on Sundays. I grew up in that atmosphere as far back as I can remember. My father was a pastor. The first church I remember him taking was in a town called Dothan, Alabama. And I was about 5 years old, and at this time my father was actually the youth minister to the kids in the church. And we had gone on a youth retreat one weekend, and because of how little I was, I went everywhere with them. And that weekend at the retreat, there was a man there, and I don't know if it was because what was going on in the weekend or anything else, but I did what the Baptist people said that you needed to do, and I went and I asked Jesus to live in my heart, okay? And I became a Christian. And at the age of 5, you would think, man, that's a little odd. And even when I see 5-year-olds today, I think, man, it's hard to believe that I could even comprehend any of that. But I knew exactly what was going on. And my parents were trying to make sure that I understood the commitment that I had just made. And I did, completely. And to be honest with you, I love the atmosphere. I love the church. I love the people in the church. I loved what my father did, being in the middle of all that, and it was just a really, really neat time. And you need to know, I love God better than anything. And I grew up in a household that taught me and told me that God can do anything. But I grew up in another type of household. I also grew up with a father that not only was he a Southern Baptist minister, but he also physically abused his children. And I grew up in this household where, and I talk about that a lot, but I don't want to make it sound like that every time my dad turned around, he was beating us. It wasn't that kind of a thing. But every time that we got in trouble, it was pretty bad. I've got a brother and sister that are 8 and 10 years older than I am. And they caught the brunt of most of that, and I watched a lot of that go on. But they were so much older than I was that when it came time for them to leave home, it was almost like being an only child. I was there by myself. And my father didn't have anybody else to take his anger and his grief out on. And so it got bad after a period of time. But what I need to tell you, too, is that I didn't know any different. I didn't know any better. Okay? I thought what was going on in my home was going on in your home. I thought what was happening to me was happening to you. I just thought that that was the way things went. I grew up a lot more naive and gullible than I really like to admit that I did. I didn't even know how to explain it. It was just, I assumed everybody was good. I assumed everybody was Christian. I assumed everybody was just, in the stories that you heard about the bad things were going were just, that's what they were. They were just stories. And I just really assumed that everybody was good-hearted people. And so this continued on through my childhood, and about the age of 12, there were some ladies that went in front of the deacon board and made some accusations against my father. And to this day, I don't know if they're true or not. That's my father's story, not mine. But the accusations were so bad, we uprooted and went to another church. My father took another church in Charleston, South Carolina, and I started going to a Christian school over there. And mom and dad were starting to have a lot of problems. There was a lot of arguing going on in the home, a lot of yelling, a lot of screaming. I was acting out, age 12, preteen, that kind of thing, you know, just that kind of, just that behavior. And I'd gotten in trouble at school one day, and I got home, and my father stripped me down to nothing but my underwear and beat me 30 times with a belt from the back of my neck all the way down the back of my legs. And the embarrassing part about that was being in a Christian school is that you had to shower in front of the other guys in PE, and there was a lot of embarrassment and a lot of shame. And you would have thought, you know, in this day and time, somebody would have called the police or something, and nothing like that happened. That afternoon when my mother got home and saw what my father had done to me, she said that was it. And she took me out of that home, and we left my father. And so you need to know that I walked away with that with three very, very important things. First thing is, I walked away from that and I hated my father. I hated him. I began to realize that what my dad was doing to me and had done to my brother and sister weren't right. And I hated him for it and what he had become and what he had done. Second thing was, I hated the people in the church. Bunch of hypocrites. They'll talk one way one time and they'll turn right around and do something else. And I watched these people that talked about how much they loved my father and loved my family turned on him, and it was terrible. And I hated the people in the church. You need to know, too, that I have a gift. That gift is that I can hate whole groups of people just for the actions of a few. Okay? It wasn't just those Christian people. I hated all of them. So you need to know that. And the next thing, and probably the most important thing, is I walked away from that situation. I hated God. How could a God that was so powerful and so all-being and all-wonderful, how could he allow something like this to happen to my family and happen to me? And that day I renounced God. And I remember that day walking out to the front yard, and I told God, I said, if you'll leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. And that's the way I began my life. There's a book called A New Pair of Glasses that was taken from a talk of Chuck C. gave. And he said, we have two alternatives. He said, one is that we can choose a God-centered life and suffer the consequences, or we can have a self-centered life and suffer the consequences. Unbeknownst to me, at the age of 12, I chose a self-centered life, and I was going to walk that path. My mother brought us back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I got family there, and we went to go live with my grandmother, and my mother stayed in church. I wasn't going to set foot back into another church again. I wasn't going to darken the doors of a church. Really had not, and again, I tell you, I was pretty naive and I was pretty gullible. I mean, I'd been pretty sheltered as a kid. And my sister at this time, she's still living in North Georgia, and we're going to see her pretty frequently. But she's had my mother's first grandchild, my first nephew. And we're going over and we're visiting her a lot, and they've got friends over, and they're having a big time, and they're drinking, and there's all kinds. Now, I've heard about drinking. But from it was a sin, in case y'all didn't know that, and I didn't, you know. So I was really concerned for my sister. You know, she's over here behaving this way. But you know, I'm watching them and I'm seeing them, and it really looks like they're having a good time. They're having fun. They're having a blast, and it all seems to be centered around this alcohol. And so 12, 13, my job at this time, I'm going to stay and I'm going to babysit my nephew, and they're going to go out for an evening, and they're headed out the door. My brother-in-law turns to me and he says, "You can have a drink of liquor if you want to. It's in the cabinet." And again, it wasn't a moral decision. It wasn't anything that, you know, I should or shouldn't do or anything else. I mean, they went out the door. They hadn't been gone just a few minutes. I go to the cabinet and I pulled out a fifth of Captain Morgan's spiced rum. I usually get a reaction from that. Y'all didn't drink it. And, yeah, there you go. Oh, Captain, my Captain, right? So I go in and I mix this Coca-Cola with the rum, and I take the drink, and nothing happened. I fix another drink, and then that thing that makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows occurred. It just for the brief moment, as I look back on my life, what alcohol has always been for me was it was the fear killer. And alcohol killed the fear inside of me so quick and so fast that I thought I should have been drinking in kindergarten. I mean, that's honestly the way that I felt. You know, I could have used a drink a long, long time ago. Now, again, at that age, you know, it's not, you can't run down to your local liquor store and get a drink. So, but I was frequenting my sister's house as much as I possibly could. And so started that path. And, you know, I didn't go headlong into alcoholism. Every opportunity I had to drink, I drank. I do believe in our singleness of purpose. I won't get into drugs too deep, just to let you know that they were there. At that age, honestly, it was a lot easier to get that than it was alcohol in a lot of cases. So, I also had what I thought was a moral compass with that too. You know, smoking weed is not near as bad as snorting cocaine. You know, or you know, doing this wasn't near as bad as doing that. So I had sort of a little moral compass going there. As long as I wasn't doing this, I was okay. And that started my journey through this deal. By the time I was in high school, I was the guy that was selling drugs and selling alcohol to the other students. And I was a hoodlum, by choice. I mean, I just lifestyle that I chose. And kids knew that they could come to me, they could come see me, and I could set them up or do anything like that. But my junior year in high school, there was a girl that was a cheerleader. She played on the basketball team. Come to find out she liked me, which I thought was odd because we were two different sets of people. And as I like to say, people, I found out the girls like that, like guys like me. I didn't know that. We started this relationship with one another. And I had dropped out by the end of my junior year, I dropped out of high school and found out I could make money. I didn't have to go to school. And so I started that path, and but it was getting to the point where it was becoming a daily thing. I was drinking pretty heavy. By the time I was 18, it was becoming a daily routine for me. I was able to get into bars in Chattanooga pretty young, started drinking in those places and hanging out with sordid groups of people and doing those kind of things. And I'd gone to a party with my work one night and took my girlfriend at the time with me, and we were out on a boat in Chattanooga and had alcohol on the boat, and I'm drinking and showing my butt, and we get off the boat and she says, "That's it, I've had enough. I can't do this anymore." She said, "I'm not going to sit around and watch you destroy yourself with alcohol." And during this process, my sister had gone to treatment. I didn't know what that was. I just knew that she had had some sort of problems, and she had gone into treatment to get some help for her alcoholism. And she had come back, and she had reassembled her family. And I heard this girl tell me, this person that I feel and believe that I love, just told me she's going to leave if I don't stop drinking. So the first thing out of my mouth is I'll go to treatment. And not even knowing what I'm saying or knowing what I'm talking about, you know. I just don't want her to leave. So she calls my brother and sister. They come pick me up at a drunken stupor and take me to my first treatment center in November of 1989, a place called Crossroads, 18 years old. And I took their little test that they gave you, and says that I came back a chronic alcoholic at 18, which I thought was kind of, I don't think so. But what you need to know is I didn't go there because I had a problem with alcohol. You know, I went there because I thought I was getting ready to lose somebody that meant a lot to me, or at least I thought meant a lot to me. So while I was there and in treatment, I heard some stuff. I used to say nothing really came out of that. I do know today that the seed was planted. But while I was in there were a lot of people in there that were on some hard times. And I had this Christian background, so I was trying to help the other patients that were in the hospital, you know, and give them some guidance and show them some, you know, just trying to help them out. I graduated from treatment and got out. 60 days after that, my girlfriend and I are at a party, and she said, you know, I think you could probably have a beer. And I'm thinking, phew, good. You know. And I drank that beer, and I don't know about you, but I go from 0 to 90 pretty quick, and I was off and running again. It was just a short period of time that she said, I can't do this anymore, and she left. My mother had gone, and she had gotten a little bit of Al-Anon about her as a result of me and my sister. And my mother told me, she said, I can't stand to sit around and watch you kill yourself. She said, you got to go. And, today I know how hard of a choice that must have been, or how hard those words must have been for her to say to her son. And I packed up my stuff. And my father at this time had moved into Florida. And I get down there, and my father's in the throes of his own alcoholism. He's drinking a fifth of vodka a day, and he's eating Xanax. And I'm watching him, and, that was a hard transition for me. I've seen him what I would have thought would have been his best, and now I've seen him at what looks like his worst. My father and I did a lot of drinking together. We did a lot of that kind of stuff, and really a sick, sick, sick situation. I've been down there about 2 weeks. That girl calls that I was dating. She flew down, and we got married. You say I'm spontaneous like that. And we're down there in Florida, and she hates it. And she said, I don't want to stay here. So she's got me. I got to go now. And she tells me, she said, and I told her, I said, listen, Chattanooga's my problem. And I ain't going back to Chattanooga. Well, she wants to be close to Mama. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll compromise, and we'll move to Nashville, Tennessee. And so we moved to Nashville. I had a pretty decent little job. I'm still drinking pretty heavily. I brought my alcoholism right into that relationship. I would go and get my paycheck on Friday. I'm a blackout drinker, or time travel, as some of us say. And I would go in and I would cash my check. I'd start drinking on Friday afternoon, and I may not come home till Sunday or Monday. And I couldn't tell you where I'd been or who I'd been with or what I'd done. And she just couldn't deal with that anymore. In about a 9-month period of time, I completely drank and destroyed that marriage. I still remember the day that she left. And it was hard for me. It's the mere fact of sitting there knowing that, again, the person that I think, feel, and believe I love has told me she's had enough. She's leaving. Guys, I don't want to drink. I really don't want to drink. You know, I'll give this up to have her, but what I don't know is I can't give this up. I can't give it up. The book talks about the fact of getting to the point where we find out that I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it. I mean, that's exactly where I was at. But I couldn't have told you what my problem was. I didn't know that alcohol was my problem. We'll get into that in a minute. So she left. My brother and my brother-in-law and my dad came and picked me up in Nashville. I was a mess. My dad at this time has moved into Kentucky, and I go up into Bowling Green, Kentucky. I've been all over the place. Alcohol takes me to a lot of places. And I get up there, and I'm there for a short period of time. And I need to tell you, too, I'd had personal relationships when it came with alcohol, and I had those kind of situations come up. Never had any kind of legal problems. Man, it seemed like as soon as I got into Bowling Green, Kentucky, the cops were just gunning for me. You know, the new kid out of southern Tennessee or northern Georgia, and he's in our town. And, I mean, it just every time I turned around, I was getting in trouble. I was out one night, and I got my first DUI. And went out with a buddy of mine one night, and I came back. And he took me over and introduced me to this girl. And her and I started seeing one another, and man, she was awesome. She drank just like I did. And we started seeing one another, and it's Chrissy, and for those of you who haven't met her, and we started running with each other, and man, she drank just like I did, and we just had a ball, and for a short period of time, and we're going along, and things are moving along, and within that 6 month period, I had this one DUI, I've got my second DUI, 2 weeks later, I got my third DUI. State of Kentucky, 3 within a year, was a felony offense, and I was looking at going to the penitentiary. And then at the same time, she came to me and told me she was pregnant. And she was listening to a CD of a girl named Sonny that's in the program, and I think Butch and I were talking about it the other day. It was that I didn't come to AA looking for the light. I came running from the fire. I mean, that's exactly the way that it is for me. You know, it was... I didn't just wake up one day and decide I was going to do the deal. I promise you, there was a bunch of stuff behind me, and my butt was on fire. So I've got legal problems. I've got a baby on the way. I've got all this stuff going on. Man, it sounds like a really good time to go to treatment. And so my stepmother knew the judge, and she went and talked to him, and they worked out a deal. I ended up back into another treatment center again, and something happened. I'm not sure what it was. I went into this treatment center, and I wanted to do something different. You know, the book talks about that we had moral and philosophical convictions galore. Guys, I was raised with morals and values. When it came to Chrissy and came with the baby, I knew what my moral obligation was, and I knew what the right thing to do was. And so, you know, I went through treatment, and I got done with that deal, and through a series of events, her and I decided at that particular point that we weren't going to get back together, and so I moved into a men's halfway house, and I got a sponsor in name only, and started doing that bit, and he and I would only call him when I need him. And the thing for me was like I told you just a few minutes ago, I hated God. So every time that we got into a position where I had to work the steps or look at the steps, every time I got to the third step, I didn't want to fool with any of that stuff. I've tried God before, and that didn't work for me. Okay. You know, I'll do the deal or I'll try the deal, but we're going to have to do it another way because this isn't going to work for me. So I stayed well away from the steps. I just wasn't going to do that thing. So, I ended up marrying somebody else in the program, and so we started this relationship with one another, and I was sober from 1993 up until about 1996, and for 3 years. And I meant to ask him, is there anybody here in their first year of sobriety? Anybody? A few of you? Okay, I'm glad you're here. Just to let you know that for 3 years, I stayed sober on nothing but service and recovery, or service and unity. That's all I did. Did a lot of service work. My sponsor had me doing stuff. We had a conference in that town. I was doing stuff for that, and I was doing stuff for the men's halfway house. I was staying busy with that kind of stuff. We went bowling. We went camping. We played volleyball. So I was hanging out with those groups of people. So I'm here to tell you, especially you newcomers, I can at least attest to you that you can stay sober at least 3 months without working the steps, or 3 years without working the steps. I did it. But I'm also here to tell you that if you don't work them, that two things may happen. One, you're either going to drink again, or the other is you're going to be one that miserable SOB, I promise you, because I was. In 1996, I was a mechanic for Nissan, and they flew me to Orlando, Florida. And while I was down there, the book says that there'll come a time when we have no mental defense against the first drink. And I'd gone out to eat with a couple of guys that night, and I was trying to get in to get a Coke at the bar, and I turned around, one of the guys handed me a beer before I knew it, and I drank it just like that, and I was off and running again. From 96 until 1998, I would do some of the worst things I've ever done, and behave in such a way that I didn't think it could get any worse, but AA is the only place that it gets worser, right? That's the only place where that word's real is worser than AA. It got worser, I promise you. And I began to do things that I swore that I would never do. And that moral compass that I was telling you about, I kept lowering the bar, lowering the bar, lowering the bar. Just to give you an example, I'll tell you a little story. I was in a crack house, and I told you I was trying to, I wasn't a crack addict. Okay, So I'm sitting in a crack house. I got a gallon of early time between my leg, and I'm pulling off this gallon, and I'm chasing it with a Coca-Cola, and there's two guys sitting across the table from me. One of them in particular, Donnie. Donnie's over lighting and smoking his crack pipe, and he's just going to town on it. And that man looked at me, and he laid that crack pipe down. And with all the sincerity that he could muster, he looked at me, and he said, "Buddy, you're an alcoholic." I want to say, if you got a crack addict telling you to take a look at your alcoholism, you might want to do that. But again, you know, I was looking, I wasn't doing that kind of stuff, so I wasn't that bad, you know, and that's how I was engaging some of that. There would come a time where I would be doing some of those things that I said that I would never do. 1998. Oh, by the way, my sobriety date's August 17th of 98, so this past Friday was 14 years for me in this program. And on August the 16th, 1998, I woke up to one of the worst days I could ever possibly imagine. I had, like I told you a few minutes ago, I had married somebody else in the program. We had had a child together, and we were living in this apartment. And she had picked up our daughter, and she had left smartly. I got pretty violent this last go around. And she took our daughter, and she left. And the only thing that I had left in that apartment was a mattress on the floor and some clothes. And I'm just living in filth. And you know how we get, just I don't care about anything except for the next drink. And I'm coming downstairs, and she had left a mirror up on the in the foyer right there. And as I'm walking down the steps, I just happen to turn and catch a glance of myself in the mirror. And I didn't recognize the guy that I was looking at. And I started wondering what happened to the kid with all the potential. And what happened to the kid that loved God and had all of her life. What happened to that person? And I went downstairs, and again, there's not really anything profane about or profound about what it is that I did. You know, it's just one of our stories. I just threw my hands up and I just asked for help. And I did the only thing that I knew to do, and I picked up the phone and I called one of you. And the next day, a friend of mine, Lisa, she came and they picked me up and they took me into what I hoped to be my last treatment center. And it wasn't necessarily because I needed treatment. It was just I needed to get away from the people that I rip and run with and the situations that I get in. You know, I needed a break from that kind of stuff. So as I'm going into the treatment center, and, you know, it's very important I tell you, and I love Al-Anon. I love you folks to death. And the lady that helped me while I was in treatment was a member of your fellowship. And she was my counselor that while I was there. And, you know, and I thought I was getting real nasty about that. You know, I thought, you don't even know what, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know how I feel. You're not an alcoholic. And trust me, she knew exactly how I felt, and she knew exactly what I was going through. And, but she turned to me. She said, "Matt, you've been in three different treatment centers." She said, "What's going to be different this time?" And I didn't have a sufficient answer for her. I didn't know what was going to be different this time. All I knew is that I was to the point, I was so sick of me, I couldn't even hardly stand being in the same room with me, you know. I was just getting on my own nerves kind of thing, you know, and I didn't know what was going to be different. I didn't have a sufficient answer for. And I'm still on the fence with the God stuff because I don't know that I really want to try that route or that atmosphere to try to go through this deal. So I called Lisa, the girl that took me into treatment. I told her, I said, "They're not going to let me out of here if I don't get a sponsor." So Lisa goes and she gets me a name of a guy named Harold M. And I'm thinking of all the guys in AA to pick for me, this is not the guy I would have picked. Harold been sober. I was four when Harold got sober. And I've been in meetings with Harold, and Harold talks big books, steps, traditions, service work, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just all that stuff. And so I bit the bullet and I picked the phone up and I called Harold and I said, "They're not going to let me out of here until I have a sponsor and I do a fist step." And he said, "I don't do treatment center fist steps. Call me when you get out." Click. He hung up on me. I thought, well, I'm already feeling the love. And I found somebody in the room or in the treatment center that listened to my fist step. I got out and I called Harold up, and Harold said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Matt." He said, "I'll make a deal with you." He said, "If you get an issue or a problem, anything like that, that you and I together can't come to a solution to," he said, "I'll buy your first bottle for you." I thought, perfect. That's a great deal for me. So, again, I got a sponsor name only. I'm going to meetings. not doing much. About the first 30 days, I'm not doing much of anything. I'm just going to meetings. And I picked up the phone and I called Harold and I said, "That's it, I'm out." And I said, "I can't do this. This is just too hard." He said, "All right." And he said, "Just do me a favor." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "When you get back out on the streets ripping and running, doing the things that you do," he said, "I want you to do me a favor." I said, "What's that?" He said, "When those people that saw you going to AA and saw you going to treatment ask you what happened, does AA not work?" He said, "You tell them you don't know." And I didn't have a sufficient argument for that. You know, I think I said something smart and I walked off. And Friday and Saturday nights, I had big speaker meetings in Kentucky. And I went to a speaker meeting that night. And the girl that spoke was a girl named Riz. And Riz was like I was. She's in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And she'd managed to put a gear together. And so I was trying to listen to what it was that she had to say. And Riz got through her talk, and her sponsor was somebody that I had grown to love quite a bit. I used to go to the morning meetings over there, and they'd bring me cups of coffee, usually half full, because I couldn't hold a whole one. And her sponsor would just sit over there and just pat me on my back and tell me that she loved me. And it's kind of like was Edith that was talking about, you know, that touch of the hand, the AA, you know, just that needing to feel okay, or that, you know. And she gave that to me, and Riz was talking about the impact that she had had on her, and she said that her sponsor told her that alcohol was her solution. Her solution was killing her, and it was time to find a different solution. And for the first time, 9 years in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard what she said. I didn't know alcohol was my solution. I thought it was my problem. But hindsight being 20/20 and looking back on my life, when the chips were down and things were going south in my life, the answer that I had every single time was the same. I'll pick up the bottle. I'll know what to do. That was my answer to everything that was going on in my life. And I went to Harold and I told him, I said, "I'll do anything that you tell me to do. What do you want me to do?" And he said, "I only know one way to do this, and it's through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he started me through this journey. And for the first couple of years through this deal, you know, Harold took me through the book, and I need to tell you that, I'm one of those people that my relationship with God has been established through a series of events, through a period of time. I'm not one of these people that just me and God's just hand in hand walking off and everything was wonderful. It's just, that has not been my experience. But I came here with a lot of anger with God, and, but I was doing the deal, and for a long period of time, the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous were my higher power. You know, those are the people that I used and the people that I talked to, and it was just the way that it had to work for me. I was at a bonfire one night, and Chrissy showed up, and my other relationship had dissipated, and she came over and she spoke to me, and we got to talking to one another and decided we'd never given the relationship a shot. And this past January, we just celebrated 12 years of marriage. And I got it right that time. and it's been one of the gifts. You know, I get to share this way of life with somebody that loves this program just as much as I do. And it's just really, really neat. And then fast forward a bit, Chrissy and I ended up moving to Chattanooga. And at first, we weren't sure why. And evidently, God had a plan, and I started some meetings. We started doing some stuff with AA, and they were struggling. They were having some tough times, and all her and I knew to do. I mean, we were calling Bowling Green complaining because, you know, people don't do AA right in different areas. That's where you get right. And we're complaining to our sponsors, and we're doing all that stuff, and our sponsors telling us the same thing. You know, quit complaining about it. Go and do something about it. You know, we've been taught that, you know, and just go and get to work. And that's why we did that deal, and we got into the middle of it. And I started sponsoring guys, and we were being sponsored, and it was just a really neat period of time. About 2007, I went to a men's retreat right outside of Nashville, and had kind of hit a brick wall in recovery, and it was one of those kind of things, you know, where you're sitting in the rooms and you're watching somebody, and you could tell, man, they really got something going on, and I could just tell there was something missing in my life or some aspect of it. And so I went to this men's retreat, and the two speakers that weekend were Sandy B and Jerry J. And got to spend a weekend with those two men, and it was absolutely phenomenal. And those men just blew my socks off. It was just really a neat weekend, and changed my life. And while I was there, I got a sponsor. I found one that was in Nashville. And I had done a lot of big book studies. I'd gone through the steps. I'd, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I asked Bill, I said, will you sponsor me? He said, I'll take you on. He said, but we're going to go back through the steps again. And I'm thinking, dude, I know the steps. I know the book. You know, what are you going to do? So it just being a little AA arrogant, I guess. And but he said, you know, it doesn't matter. We're going back through. And so we started the process, and we started going through the book. And I was making my list for my four-step, and my dad's name came up. And, you know, I'd written about it before, but I'd really never dealt with it or never really even talked about it or discussed it, you know, my childhood and the things that had happened. And when I did my fifth step and Bill heard that part of my story, he said, AA's taking you as far as it can with this. And that statement kind of confused me. And he said, you're going to need to go get some outside help, just like our book talks about. And working together, he and I found a counselor that was actually familiar with our way of life and the 12-step program, and I started going and seeing a counselor. And so I'm meeting with this counselor, I'm talking to my sponsor, and we're working through this deal, and I'm talking to this counselor about two things. We're talking about God, and we're talking about my father, and we're talking about all the stuff that happened during that period of time. After about 7 months, it was time for me to go back to Kentucky and make amends to my father. And I remembered as a kid my dad telling stories. My family's been riddled by this disease. My dad used to tell stories that when he was a little kid, that he would go visit his mom, and when he'd go visit her, that she would lock him up in the back seat of the car for hours on end while she'd go inside and drink, and bringing strange men home and doing all those kind of things. And just some of the stories he was telling, I mean, my heart broke for my father. And I called my dad, and I said, Dad, will you meet me at a coffee shop? And he said, I'd be more than happy to. And we went into this coffee shop together. And you need to understand, my life changed as a result of 8 and 9. You know, that's where life changed for me. And I go into this coffee shop, and I see this old man sitting there. And I go in, and I made amends to my father. I didn't bring up the stuff that my dad did to me. What I did was bring up the things that I did to my father. You know, I'd spoke ill of my dad. I had used what he had done to me as an excuse to treat people any way that I thought I wanted to treat them. And I used that as a green light to behave any way that I thought I wanted to behave. And I went and I made amends to my dad for the way that I had acted and the things that I had done. And, you know, something neat happened for me, because after that amends process was over, I reached over and I gave that man a kiss on his cheek. And I felt a love and a compassion for that man I've never felt before in my life. You know, and I wouldn't, that wasn't even anything that I was looking for. You know, it was just a neat experience for me. I could see my father for who he was. And, you know, it was one of John's CDs that even helped me through some of that part of that, you know, where he was talking about his dad and you know, realizing that my father, what the things that my dad did to me, they weren't personal. They weren't personal. My dad was doing the best that my dad could do with what my dad had, and that was it. You know, as we moved on from there, Chrissy was dating a guy that was mean and big, and I'm a lover, not a fighter. And so, but he made me nervous, and he gave us a little bit of an issue, and her and I first started dating, and he was on my amends list, and her and I had gone through an event a few years before that, and I drug that man through the dirt and said some really hard and nasty things about him. And he and I were cordial with one another, but there was always that something there, you know. And so I had this amends list, and I went with him, and I sat down with him, and I told him, I said, you know, here's what I've done, and blah, 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 and I made my amends to him. And I walked away from that, and he really didn't even act like he like my amends. My feelings were kind of hurt, so and I walked away from that. Later on that year, it was Christmas time, and he came by to drop his son off, and I stuck my head out the door, and I said, why don't you come in and have Christmas dinner with us? And he said, no. He said, I gotta go. And I turn around and go back into the kitchen. This big man follows me into the kitchen, and he reaches down and he gives me a hug, and he tells me that he loves me and he appreciates the father I've been to his son. You know, again, it was another one of those things that I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting that outcome. And he and I today have a great relationship with one another. You know, we have his, hers, and our children, you know, but it works out great. And he's a active member of our fellowship as well. And, you know, when Chrissy and I do weekends like this, a lot of times he stays at the house and watches the kids for us while we're gone, you know, and just to think that something like that could have even occurred or happened. I was coming back from Kentucky. I seen my daughter for the weekend, and I used to say God talked to me. I don't say that anymore, but well, I need to go back and tell you something. It was moments like the amends with my father and the thing that happened with Jimmy that God would put just a little tinge of himself inside of me, and I could see that God was showing up and that he was there, you know. And that's how that began to happen for me. I would begin to see God in just almost every aspect of things that were beginning to occur and begin to happen to me. I was coming back from Kentucky, and I'd gotten this overwhelming feeling I needed to go back to school. And I called my sponsor, and he told me the same thing my sponsor always tells me. He said, you do the footwork and see what God has for you, and let God do the deal. And I called some friends in AA, and they told me the same thing. So I did the paperwork. I thought, you know, they're never going to take me into one of these places. And I was a high school dropout. I'd been out of school for 20 years. I mean, it was going to be a pain. And I'd watched other people go to school, and I knew all the things that were going to be required, and I thought they're never going to take me into school. And I put an application in on Monday, and Wednesday I was sitting in class that same week. I mean, it was that fast. It just blew me away. And it was a Christian college. And I was kind of surprised by that. And And I started going to classes, and I started taking a psychology class. I thought one way or another, I'm going to figure out what's wrong with me. So I started taking these psychology classes, and I started, and I'd gotten to be pretty good friends with the lady that was overseeing the class and the professor. And we got to be pretty good friends, and she knew kind of my history in AA and the things that were going on with me. And she said, I got a retreat I'd like for you to go to. And I said, I got retreats all the time. She said, no. She said, this is a little bit different. She said, I'd like for you to go to one of these. And I said, it's a Christian retreat, isn't it? And she said, yeah. And I said, I don't do Christian retreats. And and she hounded me that whole semester. And I didn't go. Next semester, I had her again, and she still on me about going. And finally, I said, listen, I'll go. Fine. Okay. It was Thursday through Sunday, and I get there, and it's all these Christian men, and it's this big weekend that we're having together. And they march us into this place, and they kind of tell you how the lay of the land is going to go for the next 4 or 5 days, or 3 or 4 days. And they march us into this other little room, and they're sitting there, and they got us in these little groups, and we're doing all this stuff, and I'm thinking, I don't want to be here. God Almighty, I don't want to be here. And I'm locked in this place with all these Christian men, and it's just really a strange event. And so that was on Thursday. Friday, I was feeling even more just don't want to be here. I don't like this. I just don't want to be here. And so I finally made arrangements to go and talk to the pastor that was kind of overseeing the deal. And I said, listen, I said, there's been a huge mistake. I said, I'm not supposed to be here. And and I told him, I said, at that time, you know, I'd been in the program for a little while, and I told him, I said, I need to go. And he told me, he said, you know, Matt, he said, I know a little bit about AA. He said, that's neat. He said, I'm proud of you. He said, well, why don't you just hang out for us for the weekend, just see what happens. I was like, I don't want to do this. And so I bit the bullet. And I'm praying because, you know, I don't know about God in your life, but I also know that occasionally there are those moments where God's trying to teach me something and I'm just not paying attention. And so I'm, you know, okay, well, God, what is it you want me to learn here? And so the next day, it's Saturday morning, and the first guy that gets up that morning and he starts talking, and they were doing kind of like workshops, kind of like we do in AA, and I said it too, that, you know, they break us off into groups. It was almost like AA. And my mind began to open up just a little bit, and, you know, it really did remind me of AA, and some of the stuff they were doing even reminded me of Fifth Steps I'd heard. I thought, man, I wouldn't have shared that if I were, you know. But we're getting through the whole ordeal, and then Saturday morning, the first guy that gets up to share, he starts talking about forgiveness, and I started crying. And I'm beginning to get an idea why I'm here this weekend. And on Sunday, they march you into the auditorium back in, and when you go in, there's about 300 people sitting in this auditorium, and there are people that have been through a weekend just like that, and they're all Christian church people. I mean, just, and you've got to get up in front of these people and give them a 2-minute stint on what the weekend meant to you. And I'm bubbling and bawling. I'm crying. I'm carrying on. And I get up to the mic, and I knew exactly why I was there. And I stood up in front of those people, and I made an amends to 300 people in an auditorium for the way that I had acted towards them and the things that I had said about them. You know, I told you in the beginning that I can hate whole groups of people just because of the actions of a few. You know, it was a few people that hurt my family, but I hated all of them. And I'd really give them, I'd put Christian people up on this pedestal, and when they didn't meet my expectations or do the things that I thought that they ought to do, I just cut them down. And I think God's message to me in that is that they're my kids too. You know, you've got a way that works for you just like they have a way that works for them. Leave them alone. Yeah, leave them alone. And again, those moments, and it just really, it's been through the amends process that a lot of my life is changed. To me, that's where the power had been for me. There are so many things through that, so many things that have happened that were just amazing. I've made a conscious decision today. I'm not in school at the moment. I've had a few people that have heard me talk before. I'm taking a break from that. Chrissy went back, and she just got her associate's degree and is working on her bachelor's degree, and I'm supporting her through that, and I'm looking at other avenues and some things to do. But I still believe that event occurred in my life because it needed to occur in my life. It was a point that I needed to go through and something I needed to walk through. On my 13th AA birthday, I thought 13's an odd number. Let's see if this is going to be a hard year or not, you know, and unlucky 13, and it's been one of the hardest years I've had to go through. Actually, even leading up to it just a little bit, I got a phone call from my 15, actually, it wasn't even a phone call. Now, let me correct that. I got a text from my 15-year-old daughter. If there's any girls in here, I'm going to just share this real quick. If you've got some big news you need to let your dad in on, don't do it with a text message, okay? You know, this really should be a conversation you have over the telephone. My 15-year-old daughter called me and told me she was pregnant. And it did not settle real well with me at all. And I think just before that, Chrissy and I had some trouble with our who's now 18-year-old son. And we had to put him out of the house last year when he was 17, and just because of his behaviors and some things that he was doing, and we just weren't going to have it in our home, and it was a hard decision we had to make. So we've booted our 17-year-old son out of the house. I got my 15-year-old daughter calling, telling me she's pregnant, and I just about lost it. I mean, I thought my kids were going to be the death of me, kind of thing. And you know, my son's, even today, he's experimenting in some behavior that it really concerns me for him. But you know, when I was going through all of that stuff, and I didn't handle it very well, but the one thing that I continued to do right was to continue going to meetings, to continue calling my sponsor, and continue not drinking, you know. Eventually our son did come back home, and as long as he was willing to behave and act right, and he's been doing pretty good since then. And my daughter, I was really kind of nasty to be honest with you. Not nasty, I was just wasn't there, kind of thing. And it was really eating at me pretty hard, and I was upset with her, I was upset with her mother, and again, like I said, I didn't handle it very well. After the baby was born, she had tried to make contact with me a few times, and I was kind of flippant. And they called when the baby was born, and I took off, and I went to the hospital, and I saw that little baby, and I saw my daughter, and I saw the boy that got her pregnant. My father was there, and, I mean, it was kind of a strange ordeal. And it was amazing the impact that a grandchild would have on me. It changed my ways of thinking pretty quick. And Chris and I went back a couple of weekends later, and Taylor and Aubrey came and stayed with us and through the weekend at the hotel. And after the first night was over, she wasn't feeling good, so she went back home to her mama. But she let me and Chrissy keep my grandbaby, and which I wouldn't let go of her all weekend. I was just holding her all weekend, you know. And as we were sitting there, I guess it was Saturday night. I had to get up with her a couple times, and I fed her, and I picked her up, and I'm laying, you know how it is. You're tired, and you're trying to feed them their bottle and do that stuff, but I laid down in the bed, and I laid her on my chest, and we both fell asleep. And I woke up the next morning, and the only thing that I could remember was where it talks about in the big books, it says we could have squandered the hours that might have been worthwhile. Mm-hmm. You know, if I would have chose not to be the father or the grandfather that I need to be, you know, I could have squandered that relationship with the two of them. You know, life is just life. It continues to happen, you know. I think I was getting a little agitated because I was, okay, God, I'm doing all these wonderful things in AA, and I'm, you know, all these things are going, and how in the world could you allow something like this to happen to me? But, you know, I was listening to a CD the other day from a guy that talks about the fact there's a misconception that goes on in the rooms of AA, and that conception is that when you get sober, it's going to be okay. That is not true. That is not true. But what I will tell you this is that when you're getting sober, you will be okay. You'll be okay. You know, there's not been an incident in my life today, and that's a miracle to me. You know, we tried to, in 1935, when they found the cure for our disease, found this way of life for our disease, you need to realize that before 1935, there were people dying of this thing because they didn't have a cure for this disease. And it was a miracle. Every time one of them made it, it was a miracle. In 2012, it's just as much a miracle today when somebody does it, but it happens so often, I think we take it for granted sometimes, you know. The mere fact that I can walk through the fires of life today and not have to pick up a drink is amazing to me, you know. It's not even my first thought today. My first thought is usually to call one of you or to call my sponsor and try to get through that, you know, situation. I think I'm getting about done. I'm going to close. I close the same way every time. That weekend I was at that men's retreat, Jerry and Sandy were sharing different aspects, and Jerry had shared the story, and I asked him if I could use it, and he said I could, so I've gotten permission to use it. And it was funny because we asked those two men on Saturday night, said it was called an Ask It Basket, and one of the questions that got posed to those guys, they were like 76 then, so you know, what are guys like us going to do when guys like you are gone? And they're like, hell, we don't know. You know, we're hanging on as long as we can. So they're great. They're absolutely wonderful. But this story to me, it meant a lot to me. And in some respects, I think it sums up exactly what it is that we're about. It said Lois Wilson, Bill Wilson's wife, was also one of the early people who helped form Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a great lady. She wrote a book called Lois Remembers. She remembered more than Bill did for some reason. So Lois was in New York dying in the intensive care unit in a local hospital. The manager of the general service office knew about it, and he wanted to go see her. They'd let one or two people a day go in and see her, so he made an appointment. He knew she wasn't going to come out of there, and he wanted to go and thank her for what she had done for Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked to her for a little bit and told her what was going on in AA and in the world, and then he said, Lois, I came here today because I wanted to tell you how much on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous, how much we appreciate what you've done for our fellowship. You saved our lives. Lois couldn't talk, but she took a pencil and a piece of paper, and on the paper she wrote, not me, God, and handed the paper to him. He said, well, okay, Lois, you got me. You were right. Of course it was God, but you were his messenger. She picked up her pad of paper again, and she wrote, and so are you, and so are each and every one of you. We do have a job here, and our primary purpose is to make sure that that door is open for the next newcomer that comes through. Guys, we've been given a hell of a deal here. You know, we have. I live a way of life today that is absolutely phenomenal. And it's, you know, if you'd have told me 14 years ago that this is where I'd ended up, I'm not so sure I'd have gone. But I sure have enjoyed the ride. Harold told me a long time ago, Matt, he said, if you made a list of what you expected to get out of this deal, you would have shortchanged yourself. And that's exactly the truth. You guys have given me a way of life that I cannot even begin to repay. I can't even pay on the interest. I love you, and I appreciate you, and thank you for letting me share this weekend with you.